John Bosnich, Canadian citizen, relocated to Belgrade, Serbia, where I've been living for the past 13 years.
Can you tell us about your bit of your business and diplomatic experience?
I was quite active in local, student, city, and provincial politics in Canada in the 1980s. I went to Japan in 1989. I stayed in Japan for 18 years. During my time there in Japan, I became an advisor to the Japanese Prime Minister's office, and at the same time was an advisor on not just political affairs, but also on economic affairs. I worked as an editor at the Yomiuri Shimbun, which was at that time the world's largest newspaper. And I worked at the Nikkei Weekly, which was their English branch of their largest economic newspaper. I also worked there as an advisor to the American Chamber of Commerce in Japan and the Foreign Correspondents Club of Japan, which is the second largest in the world after the one in Washington.
John, what do you make of the move from Moscow into Ukraine? It caught a lot of people by surprise. Did it catch you by surprise?
Well, it was a it was an anticipated worst case scenario. There's an old saying that no army's ever been raised that didn't get used in a war. So what we had here was, on the Russian side, there was a strong anticipation and supporting intelligence information to say that there would be a full-scale offensive from the Ukrainian side against the Donbass in the effort of occupying and taking over Donbass completely this spring. So the Russian move to surround Ukraine on every side that it could deploy troops was a warning to the Ukrainians that if they were to take an action against Donbass, they would be facing a counterattack on at least five fronts. And if you want to visualize the situation, I don't know if you've ever seen Akira Kurosawa's famous film, Iran, but at one point in the battle, to disrupt the activities of one of the attacking armies, the opposing side produced several armies on the mountaintops surrounding the field of battle and thereby frightened the aggressor away from doing battle. That appears to have been President Putin's attempt and his intent. And when that did not work, the result was that he had to deploy his troops or face the offensive that he had tried to stop.
But I mean, there's also a lot of people saying that this was a trap that he's fallen into here.
Well, I mean, these are, everything is theoretically possible. This reminds me of a Ben and Jerry cartoon for kids, if that's the right name, where the mouse is always trying to catch the cat. There is no.
You mean Tom and Jerry, surely?
Tom and Jerry, right? Thank you, Tom and Jerry. So, I don't see a Russia being caught here. Russia's forces are deployed in a very strong position in Ukraine. NATO has indicated that it's not going to send troops into the area. The domination of the skies is now in the hands of the Russian military, the Russian Air Force, and if for some reason NATO were to deploy some of its F-35s, then Russia would have a fantastic opportunity to prove how good the SS-400 rocket systems are and shoot the F-35s out of the sky, because they don't have a chance against rockets that are going six times faster than the airplanes.
It sounds to me like you're non-committal on whether this was a trap or not.
Did NATO provoke Russia to enter into Ukraine so that they could trap the Russian army in Ukraine? No. NATO is not set up to take any advantage of the fact that Russian soldiers and Russian equipment are on Ukrainian soil. But of the military dispatches that I've been reading, I worked as a war reporter through the 90s and straight through into 2007 and 8 on the front lines across the former Yugoslavia. I have reasonable degree of experience in this field, more than 15 years on front lines. The pictures and the aerial photography that I've seen have shown that the Russian forces that were sent in first were not their Armata tanks. They were not their best artillery. They were not any of their hardware that could be encircled and annihilated by an aerial bombardment. So the Russian troops were not using either their best troops nor their best hardware, which has still been held back on the Russian side of the border. So there, if there was a trap, Putin did not put anything of irreplaceable value in the trap. You might recall that America sent its F-117 stealth fighter against Serbia in 1999, and Serbia shot it down. That's not happening to Russia in this scenario.
Well, there is another type of trap, and that is a kind of propaganda trap, isn't it? The idea being to use this as an excuse to further demonize Russia and literally to cut off almost all relations with the Russians.
Well, you know, the speed with which the sanctions, bans on Olympic participation. I just saw today that now the Paralympics are banning Russian and Belarusians from participating in the Paralympics, which I consider a monstrous example of NATO's overkill. Now, as for the propaganda war, there is no propaganda war taking place here. Russia is not in the propaganda war. The only place you can find any information on the Russian side in this situation is on the RT stream on Telegram, because RT has been banned from most of the networks which were carrying it in the West. So there's definitely no mass media PR loss for Russia. And I just read an interesting comment which tells a story about two Russian soldiers, two tank commanders in Berlin just after the fall of Berlin in World War II. And the one commander says to the other commander, because the media had not been giving much credit to the Russian army in World War II, there was a lot of PR in the West about General Patton and so on, and General Sherman and others, and General Eisenhower, of course. But the two Russian tank commanders in this little story that I'm reciting to you said one to the other, "Well, it looks like we lost the propaganda war." And the other one said, "Who cares?" And that's a good answer, because we're dealing with heavily armed neo-Nazis in much of the western side of Ukraine. And there is no manner of propaganda war. Even if, and this is of course impossible, but even if MSNBC and Fox News and CNN and the BBC and Deutsche Welle all lauded and praised President Putin for his incursion, that would not change the colors of any of the swastika-carrying neo-Nazis that are being eliminated in Ukraine today. They are not open to propaganda. They have their view, they've had that view, and they've passed it on for generations. These are the children, or even the grandchildren, of World War II Nazis, and they cannot be convinced by mass media to change their colors.
Okay, what about the NATO's incursions into the former Yugoslavia in the 1990s? You could, I suppose, compare Russia's moves on Ukraine to that. And of course, that eventually ended up in the breakup of Yugoslavia.
Well, in the beginning of the conflict in the former Yugoslavia, of course, it was a single country with six republics and two autonomous territories for a total of eight voting parties in the federal in the Federal Council. The difference in the Yugoslav case was that the German Secret Service, the English Intelligence Agency, and the CIA, not to mention the French intelligence services, were all active here in the former Yugoslavia for at least the period from the Olympics in Sarajevo onwards. Because the Olympics, and this is something that should be noted, one of the strings attached to the Olympics is that your borders are open. And it's a very nice way to inject agents and saboteurs in a country and have them set up networks and cells in that country for future use. So in the case of Yugoslavia, cells were created in 1984 and continued to operate until the war and the fighting broke out in 1990. So that's a 6-year lead time, not to mention all of the people who were deployed through embassies or intelligence services from the 70s at least onward. I do not think that the preparation and the activities by NATO in Ukraine are of themselves the cause of this conflict. We've got a problem in Ukraine. There's a very large portion of Ukraine which is A, neo-Nazi. In other words, they were Nazis and they're just modern Nazis. And B, racist-oriented Russophobes. And that is a product of a number of factors. On the western part of Ukraine, you've got an area which is strongly Roman Catholic and under the strong influence of the Vatican. And that's the same Vatican that set up the Solidarność labor union in Poland to rip Poland out of the Warsaw Pact. So we've got an underlying network of Western intelligence, Vatican saboteurs, neo-Nazis, and outright racists in action in Ukraine. And this hodgepodge is getting support, weapons, and let's say a PR blitz from the West, along with I think I've counted 52 in the past 2 or 3 days, 52 organizations that have either sanctioned, banned, or outlawed Russian participation in international affairs. 52 is a large number of organizations. I can assure you that they did not have the time to have their annual board members meet and vote on these subjects. So what we've got is a top-down, controlled image preparation by the West, attempting to make Russia look like a pariah to everybody in the world. But as we both know, or as any neutral observer would know, this is not going to wash. It's just a blitz. And after the blitz is done, the Russian forces are still going to be in Ukraine. And the genocidal ethnic cleansing of ethnic Russians in Ukraine by the regular army of Ukraine and by the neo-Nazi militias will be stopped.
And that's, I suppose, the main objective, really. Look, you're talking to us from the former Yugoslavia. I think
Belgrade, I'm in Belgrade now. After I was in Japan from 1989 through 2007, and the Japanese national broadcaster NHK, Nippon Hoso Kyokai, sent me as a reporter to the Balkans. And once I got back from the Balkans and reported to the national broadcaster, they seconded me to the prime minister's office because what I was reporting, and of course I came back with photos and video because nobody would believe it, what I was reporting was the exact opposite of what the Japanese were being told by the mainstream media in the West. So after I came back, I then got a team of Japanese reporters from several print media, radio media, and television media, and brought them back over to the Balkans, and they confirmed independently the reports that I had made. And that led to Japan refusing to endorse the bombing. It led to Yasushi Akashi, who was then the UNPROFOR, UN Protection Force chief in Bosnia, refusing to order the bombing that the Americans and that the British were trying to have take place.
Well, congratulations for a bit of decent reporting there. But what about now? What about it in the former Yugoslavia, in Serbia, Croatia, etc.? How do you think that people there and people that you know are viewing this incursion into Ukraine? Because, of course, it's all many people. Well, OK, so Yugoslavia was a bit different, but it's certainly part of the old Eastern Bloc, which was supposed to have been liberated to be independent back in 1989 and 1990, when the US Secretary of State James Baker said, "We promised, hand on heart, we will not move one inch to the east."
Well, you know, a lot of people are saying now that Gorbachev was a fool for not asking for that guarantee in writing. But I can assure you that even if the guarantee had been given in writing, it wouldn't have been worth the paper it was written on. The fundamental purpose of NATO in the period from the 1980s onward has been to pivot from what was presented to the people of the West. And I grew up and was educated in Canada. We were taught from all sides that NATO was the only thing standing between us and nuclear oblivion. In the 1980s, it became obvious that Russia was not planning to make an attack on Europe. It had no capacity to do so and had no intent to do so. And then NATO started to explore what its potential capacities were to continue to exist. Because after the 50th anniversary in 1995 of the end of World War II, a lot of people were talking about the disbanding of NATO as the Soviet bloc started to decay, as the Eastern European states left the Warsaw Pact. There didn't seem to be much need for NATO. And then NATO started to become a peacemaking organization. And I want to differentiate between peacekeeping and peacemaking. Peacekeeping is a word that got some currency in the 1960s when Canadian Prime Minister Lester B. Pearson, the Liberal Party Prime Minister, introduced the concept of having fair-minded countries serve as peacekeepers in the case of two states who had signed some kind of a ceasefire. This was a good development. It was used first on the Golan Heights and in some places in Africa, and it actually allowed for the peaceful coexistence of two states side by side that shared a border. This naturally frustrated the intentions of those whose empire, and I'm referring to the Anglo-American Empire, was built on dividing and conquering, following the old Roman adage. So they were frustrated by the fact that Canada and other countries like Canada were attempting to end wars by creating human buffers between the belligerent parties. Then America started talking about peacemaking. And that is when the real aggression started, when America started sending its armies around the world to make peace and make it in the interest of one side or the other in a conflict. And that was usually just a business decision based on which side would bring more profit if it had the support of the United States. And that's basically how we got to the modern current era, where we have America projecting power, not in the interest of bringing peace in a conflict. They went beyond that by pacifying enemy states, such as Iraq. Iraq at the time of the American invasion was not a belligerent party. It had its Kuwait incursion, which America tricked Iraq into doing. You will recall that the American ambassador gave Saddam Hussein the response when he asked what would happen if we reclaimed our lost province in I believe it was Kuwait, and the American ambassador's response was, "I have no instructions on that topic," which he took as a yes and a go ahead. And if you're wondering why Saddam Hussein would ask the United States whether it was of interest to them, that's because the United States had previously asked Saddam, and he agreed, to wage an 8-year war on Iran, in which America was not only supplying Iraq heavily with weapons, it was also running the Iran-Contra affair in the background to raise illegal money for the CIA by providing weapons to Iran. And so the nefarious nature of America's involvement in all of these conflicts, wars, peacemaking operations cannot be underestimated. America's hand is here. And this reminds me of Gandhi, who was describing how England played this role before World War II, before it lost its empire. And he talked about how if you went out into the forest and you walked down a little trail and the trail almost petered away and you went so far out that you find that you found a tiny little stream and beyond that a little brook and a little body of like a little brook in which there were two brother fish fighting each other and the brook is only a meter wide. Gandhi's conclusion was, when you see two brother fish fighting each other in that tiny little brook, you know one thing for sure, the English have been here.
Well, certainly the British Empire was the biggest the world's seen. It was built on the British Industrial Revolution, built on the eviction of millions of people from their country homes where they had a secure living. But they were thrown out. That whole thing massively increased after the English Civil War. But the American Empire does seem to have a deadly side to it, rather than, I mean, for example, I was just chatting with someone last year about Yemen. He was stationed in Yemen, a British soldier. And when the British were forced out of the Yemen in the 1960s, there were a score or so of casualties on each side, and the British decided, right, we've had enough here, and went home. Whereas, of course, we've seen a much, much greater death toll in the more recent era. The British obviously are siding with the Americans, but it does seem to be a US-led empire now rather than a British one. But look,
well, just
what,
a moment,
what do you
there,
think, John?
Let me put a word in there. Leadership comes in various forms. Of course, there are generals who are leading the American armies, yes. But the intellectual leadership for the war empire continues to be largely centered in England, and specifically in the Rhodes Scholarship system that trained people like Bill Clinton to be the warmonger that he was. It's a kind of a symbiotic relationship where the better educated English, who are closer to Europe, which has been in the past was the main field of major battles, would give advice and instructions to the Americans who were the brawn. So there was an intellectual leadership in England, better educated, more aware of the situation on the ground, supported by a large population of relatively undereducated Americans who were deployed. And still that's the case with the American military. These are generally people from the lower economic class of society in America who are trained in the use of weapons. The weapons, of course, are made in America, and the purpose is to use the weapons to occupy and take control of a country and then make that country an American ally, just like the Roman Empire used to make people federati or federates. And the federates would then be armed according to the Roman standard, and they would have to comply with Roman rules and pay a tax to Rome. What has happened here is the institutionalization of empire is so strong that it's no longer the way it was with the Anglo Empire, where you had ships at sea and cannon that were bombarding ports that might not submit to English demands to trade there. But you've got an empire that arrives by sea, by land, and by air. And once it colonizes a country, it makes the country a client for all of its commercial products and at the same time for its military hardware. And as everybody knows in North America, the single largest profit of any physical product is military hardware, which starts from a markup of 40 to 1, 40 to 1, $1 in, $40 out. And that's the minimum. When we're talking about aircraft and rockets, we're talking 400 to 500 to 1.
Talking about that as a kind of profit margin.
Yes, exactly. The empire feeds itself from the wars for which it provides the military armament.
Yeah, well, this is really very pernicious. You're quite right. But look, before we finish, John, yes. As you're a Canadian, I've got to ask you what you make of the convoy and also the state of emergency declared by Justin Trudeau, the young global leader of the World Economic Forum, in your home country.
First of all, I strongly support the convoy. I am not a believer in the COVID doctrine. I personally had COVID-19 twice. I caught it when I went to New York in 2020, November, and I had quite a serious case of it. And of course, I'm not allowed on the mainstream media to tell anybody about how I cured it. I took ivermectin, depending on how you pronounce it, which is presented in the mainstream media as a quack solution that kills worms in horses. I took ivermectin on day 8 of a severe case of COVID in which I was unable to see, hear, taste, smell, or even stand up due to the pain in my joints. And in 48 hours from taking ivermectin, I was fully reactivated, healed, and back in action. That was the first case. The second case happened this past fall. It would be in January. It was a 4 or 5 day case of COVID. I tested positive multiple times again, but it just passed it. I guess it was the Omicron variant, which is much weaker, and it passed by itself in 4 or 5 days, and I did not even need to use the ivermectin to kill it off. I just heard a funny joke today. No matter what anybody says negative about Vladimir Putin, about his wars, here's the joke. He's been nominated for the Nobel Prize in Medicine for single-handedly ending the COVID crisis in one day by moving his troops into Ukraine. As you'll notice, if you look in the second or third or fourth tier headlines all around the world, all COVID measures are being removed, all masks are being released across the world. And what was just a few weeks ago a pandemic that we thought we might never escape from is now being called something of the past. And just today, the latest news is, and it's convenient because Monday Night Football is coming up, the NFL has said that there is no more COVID pandemic. Good timing, guys.
But what about the state of emergency? This seems to have been quite serious with the
bank accounts being closed down,
all sorts, and actually, and the leaders being jailed, actually.
Right. First of all, I've had a relatively active political life in Canada. I was the longest serving student union leader in university in the history of North America. I served 4.5 years as a student union president at a major university in Eastern Canada. And we spent about half of our time fighting the government and fighting the police, who routinely violated our own Canadian laws. When I was in Montreal attending McGill University, I grew up in New Brunswick, a province in the Atlantic provinces. When I went to Montreal to attend McGill University, by sheer chance, I was on the scene when two police attacked a civilian bystander for no known reason and virtually beat him unconscious in front of 60 witnesses. Not one other person would testify. My testimony put the first two police to go to prison in the history of Montreal, in jail, in Montreal, Quebec, in 1987. And I learned that our system, although it looks nice and we have a pretty flag with a maple leaf on it, our system is just as corrupt as any other, but it's more pernicious and more deceptive because it looks like a free place. It's Canada, after all, the white, clean snow. But I can tell you that there's as much corruption up there. And when you've got a country that's been run by the two same parties for 150 years, you can only imagine how deep that corruption actually runs. I left Canada after putting the police in jail because the Crown prosecutor told me to my face that if I testified, he could not guarantee my safety, and he had been informed by the police union that I would only be alive for 30 days if their members went to prison. And that's why I went to Asia, and that's how I ended up in Japan and spent 18 years there, and that's how I ended up becoming an advisor to the Japanese Prime Minister, based on my experience of the West.
Wow, sounds like you were sent into exile, basically. Anyway, look, well, John, how do people follow your work? How do we find you online, etc.?
Well, you can find quite a lot just by going to Google and typing in my name. Somebody opened a Wikipedia page about another thing I got involved with. While I was serving as the Prime Minister's advisor, Bobby Fischer came to Japan on a visit, and he was arrested on a warrant issued by George Bush the Jr., who demanded that Japan arrest Bobby Fischer for playing chess in the former Yugoslavia after the United States had put sanctions on Yugoslavia. And by sheer stroke of fate, I was live on Radio Japan World Service English News, reading the news at 3 a.m. when that story first appeared for the first time on Earth, because he was arrested in Tokyo at Tokyo's Narita Airport. So I got the first story to appear on Earth about Bobby's arrest. And I read that story. And as soon as I read that story, as soon as I got off air at 3 a.m, I traced down the jail that he was being held in. I found the chess club that was supporting him, and I volunteered to represent him as his lawyer, even though I'm not a lawyer, as his lawyer, because he was refusing to accept any lawyers. And he did accept me. I forced the court to accept me as a lawyer. I defended Bobby. I got him out of jail. I ended up suing George Bush in a grand jury in Washington. And I defeated the Japanese Prime Minister's office in the parliamentary court in Japan and got Bobby out to asylum in Iceland. And that's how, in the process of getting Bobby to Iceland, I met the people who are now leading WikiLeaks, because the two reporters who came to cover the battle that I fought to free Bobby Fischer later became the head. One of them became the current head of WikiLeaks.
Well, fascinating story, John. What about
it's
Twitter?
It's an amazingly intertwined world. Once you get involved in fighting not just corruption, but just downright evil, once you find yourself in the battlefield, you'll be shocked by how interconnected all of the bad actors are all around the world. It's as if they had a network, like you would see as a child. I used to watch James Bond when Sean Connery was, and I can't remember the name of the worldwide criminal organization. Was it SMERSH? I can't remember.
Spectre.
There we are. Thank you. We are facing a politico-economic Spectre organization that just so happens to have nuclear weapons and the U.S. Army at their disposal. That's what we're dealing with on this world today. And they do a good job of disguising themselves as governments, but that's only because it's easier to pickpocket people if you're their government than it is as a criminal.
Well, I'd like to just put in a word for Ian Fleming here, because the book that I brought out last year, I look at his role in the very close connections there were between British intelligence and the Nazis at the end of the Second World War. In fact, bringing in to the UK Hitler's treasurer, Martin Bormann, right at the very end of the Second World War, who had all the signatures to all the big bank accounts, all the looted money from the whole of Europe, squirreled away mostly in Switzerland. And Fleming, of course, couldn't write about this because it was all covered by the Official Secrets Act, but he decided to get it out of his system in a series of novels.
I would like to hear more about this in the future, but I can tell you that the ruling elite in England not only did that, but they brought in now here I'm living in Belgrade, Serbia, which is the former capital of the larger Federation of Yugoslavia. They brought to power the dictator for life, Marshal Tito. That's what the English intelligence service did. They created the dictator for life of Yugoslavia, put him in power, and planned for him to come to power on the tanks of Joseph Stalin and then have him betray Stalin just 3 years later in 1948. And that was British intelligence. So if they were working with Bormann and they were working with the CIA, which was operating Operation Paperclip, where they were bringing all of the Nazi rocket scientists to work for NASA. And now we know that they are actually put Marshal Tito in power, knowing in advance that he would betray Joseph Stalin. I can say that one of the heads of this hydra of evil is definitely located in London.
It sounds to me as if we are, as journalists, basically tracking down a full-on kind of Fourth Reich, really. That is to say, a definite successor network to the Nazis. And that it wouldn't surprise me if the Allies had done so many dirty deals at the end of the Second World War. They certainly were looking at attacking Russia. Winston Churchill was very keen on that after the war.
As was General Patton during the war.
Yeah, and even talking about nuking Moscow with their newfound toy, the nuclear weapons. Maybe we can just finish now, John.
Okay, by
looking at the prospects for nuclear conflict, do you think that is again likely? It certainly was talked about a lot during the Cold War, the Cuban Missile Crisis, etc., in Europe, and there has been they're talking now about this as a possibility again, perhaps.
Well, I think President Putin has shaken the nuclear tree to frighten the people who've been hanging out in that tree, threatening the rest of the world since 1945. I can't rule out the possibility of a nuclear strike, but I would suggest that if such an event occurred, it would be a limited strike because everybody knows that the game is over if it goes beyond that. It would destroy all of the riches and all of the wealth that this cabal that took over the planet since 1945 have been amassing worldwide since that date. And when you calculate how many trillions of dollars that the Western Empire has raped the world of, the last thing they'd like to do is see it all burn up in a nuclear inferno. So I think that Putin pressed the right button when he threatened that, and that will allow him to have a free hand to root out the Nazis in Ukraine and to protect the ethnic Russians over there. This was a very, very high-stakes game of poker, but I think he's won it.
Okay, John Bosnich, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. I hope to talk to you in the future.